From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscoane with Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. On today's Fresh Air, understanding the ethnic divisions in the Balkan Republic, we talk with Toma Longinovic. 10 years ago, he left Sarajevo, where he still has family. He says when he was growing up in the 1950s, his generation didn't care if someone was Serbian, Croatian, Slovak, or Muslim. Also, After the Thin Blue Line, documentary filmmaker Errol Morris tells us about his new film on the brilliant physicist Stephen Hawking. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of compositions by John Harbison. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has approved Israel's long-standing request for up to $10 billion in loan guarantees to help absorb a new wave of immigrants from the former Soviet Union. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
President Bush made the announcement in Kennebunkport at the conclusion of a cordial visit by Israel's new Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. Rabin cleared the way for the loan guarantees by curtailing the expansion of Jewish settlements in the occupied territories, which the U.S. opposes as an obstacle to peace. Mr. Bush and Mr. Rabin discussed Israel's new policy and the loan guarantees at length.
There's enough specifics here for me to recommend enthusiastically to the United States Congress and to the American people that this is in not only the interest of Israel, but it is in our interest.
Also discussed the next round of Arab-Israeli peace talks, expected to take place in Washington on August 24th, and to reassure Israelis who worry that their country is less important to the U.S. in the post-Cold War era, Mr. Bush said Israel has strategic importance to America. This is Ted Clark in Kennebunkport.
Serbian forces in Bosnia said today that they'll allow women and children to leave the besieged city of Sarajevo. The offer was an apparent attempt to head off a decision by the UN Security Council to authorize the use of force to protect humanitarian aid deliveries in Bosnia. A self-proclaimed Serbian parliament pledged to cooperate with the United Nations. A Security Council vote on a resolution authorizing force is expected tomorrow. UN officials charged today that the Serbs were carrying out one of the biggest ethnic cleansings of the Civil War, driving some 28,000 Muslims from their homes in northwest Bosnia. Former presidential candidate and Texas billionaire Ross Perot testified all day today before a Senate committee about his knowledge concerning Americans missing in action after the Vietnam War. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
Perot said he could prove there were Americans left behind after the Vietnam War, but after hours of testimony, he offered no new evidence. Instead, Perot cited a briefing he was given by the CIA station chief in Laos, a briefing he referred to in a 1987 letter he wrote to President Reagan. He suggested that U.S. officials knowingly left Americans behind and said there was only one way to get at the truth.
I would get them all in a room and give them total amnesty, total immunity, I guess is the word you use here, anything to get them to tell you the truth, because with the truth you can move.
Perot said the U.S. should open up negotiations with Vietnam and Laos, but the Bush administration has said that its investigations have never turned up any evidence that there's a deal to be struck. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 7 points to close at 3,331. This is NPR News. A top United Nations investigator accused Iraq today of widespread human rights abuses, including summary executions, torture, and deliberate starvation of citizens. Max von der Stoel also repeated charges that Iraq has stepped up military action against Kurds in the north and Shiite Muslims in the southern part of the country. President Mubarak of Egypt has held unexpected talks with Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi in Tripoli. They discussed the sanctions imposed by the UN against Libya. Air, arms, and diplomatic embargoes were imposed in April after Libya refused to hand over two men accused of blowing up a U.S. airliner in 1988. The BBC's Simon Ingram reports.
With less than a week to go before the UN Security Council is due to discuss imposing further sanctions on Libya over the Lockerbie affair, Colonel Gaddafi has been trying to win more time for his so far unsuccessful efforts to strike a compromise. but Washington and London have refused to be diverted from their main goal, the handover into their custody of the two accused Libyan agents as prescribed by UN resolutions. Egypt has worked hard to defuse the crisis, and observers here say it's unlikely that President Mubarak would have taken the risk of visiting Libya in person unless he was confident of achieving results. The Egyptian leader may sense that with the UN's attention firmly focused on Yugoslavia, now is a good moment to try and break the deadlock and resolve an issue which he fears could have serious implications for stability in the region.
Simon Ingram in Cairo. Vice President Dan Quayle denounced the American Bar Association today for honoring law professor Anita Hill, the woman who brought accusations of sexual harassment against Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Quayle said the ABA was making a liberal heroine of Hill because she led an attack against a black conservative. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. The conflicts in Bosnia-Herzegovina between Serbs, Croats, and Muslims go back many centuries, beginning in the 12th century with the Turkish occupation of the region, through the Nazi occupation of Yugoslavia in the 40s, and the establishment of communist rule under Tito. Since the collapse of communism, Bosnia has been embroiled in a violent civil war, with Serbs bent on cleansing Croats and Muslims from the region. We called Toma Loginovic today to help us understand the roots of the current conflict, to shed some light on the level of animosity between these ethnic groups. Loginovic is a literary scholar, writer, cultural historian, and professor of Slavic languages and literature at the University of Wisconsin. I asked him if Muslims stand apart from other ethnic groups in the region.
I think that, you know, if you would, for example, go today to Sarajevo, you would not be able to tell who is a Muslim, who is a Serb, who is a Croat. I mean, maybe now you would because they all wear uniforms, but if you went before the conflict, people were so integrated and Sarajevo was sort of a model city of multi-ethnic tolerance and a city in which, you know, multicultural existence was really at its best. There was really no way of telling, you know, except you could tell maybe by the names, you know, because they would usually have beg or aga, or they would have some sort of maybe an Islamic name. But otherwise, you know, I don't think that there was, you know, any other way of distinguishing, you know, between each other, especially in the cities. Maybe in the rural areas you could tell by the dress, you know, the people wearing traditional folk dress or a costume.
Does that mean there have been many mixed marriages?
Oh, there have been, you know, many, many mixed marriages. I mean, considering that these basically are the same people, I mean, the Serbs, the Croats, and the ethnic Muslims come from the same Slavic ethnic stock. And, you know, during centuries they have also been mixing between themselves, mixing with the Turks, so that, you know, any talk of ethnic purity is an absolute fiction and an absurdity. You know, you cannot create such a thing in 20th century Europe. It is absolutely ridiculous.
The Muslims in Bosnia-Herzegovina, what kind of ties do they have to the rest of the Islamic world?
I think that, you know, right now they have very strong ties to the Islamic world, especially now that they feel sort of betrayed by the West. They have, I think, ties with almost all the Islamic countries. And during the communist rule, Tito actually tried to give them more autonomy and recognize them as a nation in the beginning of 1960s to sort of have sort of a showcase Muslim community for the Arabic countries during his you know, attempts to gain control over the non-aligned movement that he was the founder of.
Let me pick up on something you were saying about the ethnic cleansing, and you're saying this really comes from nowhere, that it's not part of the history of this region. Where then did it come from?
Well, you know, this is the whole problem and the complexity of the Balkans. As I said, Balkans is the place of one of the most intense ethnic and cultural hybridization of mixing of culture that produced, you know, amazing works of art, you know, and amazing cultural artifacts that are really nowhere to be found in the world. You know, if you went to Sarajevo, you know, it has on the same main square the mosque, the Catholic cathedral, the Orthodox church, and the synagogue, you know, and this Four major religions are to be found in one city. You know, it is sort of a true, sort of universal city. You know, although it was so far away and in the periphery of Europe. So this talk of ethnic homogeneity, I think, comes from sort of regressive drives, among the various nationalist groups within the country, who are trying to, I think, carve up sort of a political space for themselves.
Well, do you see this as a religious war, a war of revenge?
Well, you have to understand it in the Balkans, as I said before, religion is the major factor in the creation of national consciousness, So, those two things really fall together because there is no other way to distinguish between people but by their religious affiliation. The Croats and the Serbs and the Muslims all look the same. They are of the same ethnic stock. But because they have accepted a certain religion, they declare themselves as Serbs, Croats, or the ethnic Muslims.
Why do you think the Serbs have targeted Muslims when it appears that Serbs and Croatians have a darker history together?
I think, because they have not targeted the Muslims specifically. I think they are driving out from the territories that they hold both the Muslims and the Croats, trying to create a territory that they can claim their own. And I think in a way, the other nation is now seen as the enemy, which is, I think, very wrong and absolutely ridiculous.
Can you explain to us the level of violence, the fact that civilians are targeted, that school buses with children inside are shot at, that food and medical supplies are kept out by force?
Oh, it's absolutely disgusting. I'm shocked. Every day I open the paper. I can't eat my breakfast or anything. I have two small children. When I watch the suffering of little children or the civilians there, I'm just completely appalled,
But can
I
you
think that
can you
to
explain
it? It's really hard to explain violence, since this is a war, and since this is happening basically in one of the most probably volatile regions and the most intermixed regions of the world. I think we have to take into account certain psychological aspects, and maybe I'll try to explain and go in depth by doing that. I think that, in a sense, people tend to, recognize their shortcomings and see their dark side in the other nation, and by sort of exterminating or getting rid of that, let's call it shadow, in themselves, in projecting it onto the other, they attempt to sort of purify themselves.
That is a very psychological explanation.
Yes. There is no other one that I can really come up with for such a level of violence, really.
My guest today on Fresh Air is Toma Longinovich, and he's a literary scholar, writer, cultural historian. He teaches at the University of Wisconsin. He's lived in this country for 10 years. Before that, he lived in Yugoslavia. We're talking about the current conflict which is going on in Bosnia-Herzegovina. We're talking about the history of the various ethnic groups in that region. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Toma Longinovich, and he teaches at the University of Wisconsin and lived in Yugoslavia until 10 years ago and has family and friends that are still living there. Let me pick up on what you were talking about and even ask you what you're hearing from your friends, from people that are still back in what is Bosnia-Herzegovina.
I did not have any direct contact with the people there because, the telephone lines are cut. But before the conflict, I had several friends, there who were, both Serbs and ethnic Muslims and Croats. And I would send them, you know, they would want me to send them Sports Illustrated or, you know, some pictures of rock groups and stuff like this, the people that I have met while I was in the army. And, you know, I kept writing to these people, and we were great friends, but I have no way of knowing now where they are and, you know, how they are doing. I also have some family in Sarajevo, and even my family in Belgrade has no way of getting in touch with them. Yeah, we really don't know what is with them.
So does that mean you're combing the newspaper, looking through photographs as they come up in the U.S. media to see any sign of your own family?
Yeah, exactly. We are just, you know, trying to figure out, you know, what is going on and where are these people, because, you know, basically the links with the outside world are cut, you know, and who knows what is happening in there.
Well, how do you fill in those blanks?
No, it's just horrifying. You know, you fill it with anxiety and horror and apprehension, you know, that it will always be some sort of bad news, you know. It's just terrible.
So you have family that in Sarajevo right now as we speak?
Yeah, I think I have some distant relatives, and I know that people of my generation from that family have fled to Switzerland and with their young children. And I know that the older people, who, you know, my cousins, have actually stayed there, you know, and they, you know, my younger cousins were trying to get them out, and they would say, no, we have to stay here, you know, defend our home, our life is here, and so on. And this type of thinking, you know, this kind of very intransigent thinking, I think, is to a large extent what is contributing to what is happening. Nobody is willing to sort of to give up what's their own, and that's understandable. And, you know, so now it's going to be very, very difficult.
Let me ask you a little bit more about your family. And you are, your family is Serbian, and I realize these are probably distinctions that people in this country make more than you might make about yourself. Is that right?
Absolutely, because, you know, when I first came, you know, to this country, and I came as a Yugoslavian, at that time that meant that I identified with the whole, you know, country, you know, that I was on very friendly terms with all the nations, you know, within the country. And, you know, the Serbian identity just meant some sort of ethnic, cultural, adherence, you know, to a sort of a heritage in a way. And, you know, coming here immediately, you know, you start meeting people from the emigre community, and they all identify as Serbs or Croats because most of them sort of fled after World War II. And you immediately start being pulled into these camps, you know, for that this or that reason. And this was something that was very foreign to me. And, you know, right now, you know, I rather prefer to think about myself as a person without a state, you know, and, you know, person who was just by accident of birth born there. And I will definitely not seek citizenship of the rump Yugoslavia because I don't identify with the policies of Mr. Milosevic and his politicians there.
By not identifying yourself that way, does that then free you to speak as you wish?
Well, I think so. You know, I have the luxury of not being there. But, you know, in Serbia, there is very vocal opposition to Mr. Milosevic. And as we speak, the Belgrade University buildings have been occupied by students for 4 months now who are protesting and demanding his immediate resignation. Set up a group of intellectual opposition to him called the Serbian Democratic Movement, were asking for his immediate resignation and so on. Because if anybody should be held accountable for the breakup of Yugoslavia, that is probably Mr. Milosevic, who managed somehow to use the nationalist rhetorics for the first time in the Yugoslavian political space in 1987 when he crushed the uprising of the Albanians in Kosovo. And this has brought him, you know, to power. And the side effect of this was the awakening of Serbian nationalism, which, you know, gave this encouragement to the Serbs in Croatia and Bosnia to sort of seek solutions by picking up arms, which was a very, very wrong signal. And instead of all the countries of former Yugoslavia immediately recognizing each other and trying to work out a political solution by forming some sort of economic or a customs union, you know, we now have this horrifying war going on there.
Let me just ask your reaction as you read about the coverage in this country, about the fighting, the history of the fighting in Bosnia. Do you have a general impression about how the media is writing about this war?
It is quite obvious, I think, to everybody, you know, who reads that, media is clearly favoring the nations seeking independence, while the Serbs are, to a certain extent, being demonized in the media. And again, you know, who else to blame but Mr. Milosevic and his policies? He has, out of the people, you know, the Serbian people who have been always on the side of the Allies in both world wars, who are sort of the Piedmont of the Balkans, who united and created Yugoslavia, he has turned them into the pariahs of the world, you know, with his completely absurd policies of trying to prevent, you know, other nations from being having a right to self-determination and from inciting the Serbs in Croatia and Bosnia to rebellion.
Well, if Milosevic and others in power are removed in one way or another by, we'll say, United Nations forces, do you think then the country can be stitched back together? Or do you think the violence has been too deep and too profound to really allow that to happen?
Oh, I think that, you know, the Yugoslavia as a unitary state is a completely dead idea. You know, the dream has been destroyed, you know, the moment Slovenia seceded in 1991. But I think that there is definitely a necessity for some sort of, as I said before, economic and cultural cooperation between this new independent state, maybe something along the model of Commonwealth of Independent States, because they will just not be economically viable. I don't think how they will survive. They are being turned into the underdeveloped world, into the third world in Europe, I'm afraid.
In looking at the conflict and the history of this particular conflict, would you say that different generations look at it differently because they have a different history with it? People, Yugoslavs who went through World War II might look at it differently than people like you who were born in the 50s.
Oh, I'm absolutely sure of that. Yeah, I know that the generation of our parents and grandparents definitely remembers all the atrocities of the Second World War, and that we have somehow, by growing up in this Yugoslav nation, completely, we were not exposed to this kind of hatred or, you know, this kind of violence. And I think that, as I said, this is just reopening old wounds for them. Every now and then I would come across a comment. I remember when I lived for a part of my life there in Zagreb in Croatia, and I had a Croatian girlfriend. And my grandfather would always tell me, you know, how can you live in Zagreb and have a Croatian girlfriend when they killed 750,000 of Serbs just 30 years ago? And I would just laugh at him. I would say, oh, that's all over. That's all the matter of the past. That will never happen again. And now, to a certain extent, I see that he was referring back to a history that was always alive within him.
And might be occurring again now.
Yeah, I think, you know, it is happening. And that's why I said that we need a new type of thinking, you know, a thinking that is not based on revenge but on forgiveness.
Well, I thank you very much, Toma Longinovic, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Toma Longinovic is a literary scholar, writer, cultural historian, and professor of Slavic languages and literature at the University of Wisconsin. He has several books, including a novel called Moment of Silence. The Emperor's Last Island is a new book by Julia Blackburn about Napoleon, his demise, and a whole lot more. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Julia Blackburn seems to be less interested in Napoleon as a general or an emperor or a lover than she is in the idea of exile and the way we make history and how her own mind works as she writes this book. She's forever pausing to explain the order of her chapters or to digress on personal experiences that allow her to identify with Napoleon on St. Helena's during the 6 years it took him to die, of solitude, after which, in superstitious dread, the English buried him in a tin coffin inside a mahogany coffin inside a lead coffin like a nest of Russian dolls deep in a stone-lined hole in the ground of a desolate windy plain. Blackburn tells us that she knows how all this feels because of her dying stepmother and a mortician she met once and a mummified saint she saw in an Irish church and some time she spent on Mallorca with the poet Robert Graves, who was also waiting to die. Because Blackburn herself is compelling, so is the Emperor's last stand. We get a history of the island, St. Helena's, 60 million years old, and once upon a time volcanic. A great forest fit only for spiders and snails before the Portuguese arrived in 1502 and let loose some goats to breed. An earthly paradise for the next century or so, because of the fugitive nobleman Fernando Lopez, and largely barren rock by the time Napoleon first saw it in 1815. Blackburn finds this Lopez to be almost as interesting as Napoleon. He'd shipped out to build an empire for Portugal, gone native and converted to Islam in Goa, been tortured by his own officers, losing a right hand, a left thumb, his nose and ears, jumped ship en route to Lisbon at St. Helena's and stayed for 30 years. Sailors left him seeds. Out of peacocks and pomegranates, palm trees and pigs, Lopez made a garden. This garden was then despoiled by a British East India Company that cut down all the ebony trees to make acid from the bark for the tanning of hides, because there wasn't enough money in the minerals, or the salt, or the seabird droppings, or the sea cow oil, nor enough yams to feed the slaves who grew them. This godforsaken outpost of the British Empire became a prison. So send Napoleon after Waterloo to this rock and let him rot, with his snuffbox and his sword, his sauce chef, and the Chinese servants who made chess sets and painted screens for him to hide behind from the 2,000 British soldiers. Let him fatten and sicken in his marble tub, his passion flower garden, his Chinese aviary, or his fairy tale tea house with a dragon on top, dictating his memoirs to distraught and greedy secretaries from a seesaw. Leave him no choice but to learn how to die. It was as if, says Blackburn, he had raced so fast all his life that now he had to sit still and wait for his destiny to catch up with him and do what it liked in disposing of him. So much for the self-serving diaries of his doctors, priests, and sycophants, the rationalizations and wanton cruelties of his wardens, the stealers of his death mask, his heart, his stomach, and his penis. So much in this dream book for Oedipus at Colonus, Lear on the blasted heath, Bolivar on the Rio Negro. So much for glory, and so much for empire, and so much for all of us, rotting back to compost in the Valley of the Tomb, history as slaughterhouse. I can't imagine what Judith Blackburn will think of next to write about so brilliantly, but I'll buy whatever it is.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Emperor's Last Island by Julia Blackburn. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. The brilliant physicist Stephen Hawking can't move because of a debilitating muscular disease, but his mind roams the universe. His book, A Brief History of Time, about the birth and fate of the cosmos, was a bestseller. Now there's a documentary about the work and life of Stephen Hawking. Coming up, we talk with filmmaker Errol Morris. His last film was The Thin Blue Line. Also, some contemporary chamber music. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new release of compositions by John Harbison. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to UN officials in Bosnia, Serbian forces have agreed to allow women and children to leave Sarajevo. UN officials say the first bus carrying refugees will leave tomorrow. However, in the past, similar efforts have come under fire. In New York City, the UN Security Council appears close to agreement on new measures on Bosnia. Linda Fasulo reports.
Diplomats say that 4 out of 5 council members with veto power are supporting the proposed resolutions, with only China likely to abstain. And most of the remaining 10 non-permanent members are expected to vote in favor as well, making adoption appear nearly certain. The first resolution would authorize individual nations or regional groups like NATO to use all necessary measures, including military means, to bring food and medicine to Bosnia. And it orders access to prisoner of war camps as well. The second measure demands that all parties to the conflict abide by international humanitarian treaties, including the Geneva Convention, and asks countries to furnish war crimes information to the Council. Meanwhile, sources say some Islamic countries have asked the Council to lift the arms embargo against Bosnia, a request a Western diplomat says the Council is not likely to accept. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the United Nations.
Democrats and Republicans traded barbs again today over their competing health care plans. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Democratic candidate Bill Clinton was in Florida today at a meeting of the Southern Legislative Conference. The group of state legislators first heard from Health and Human Services Secretary Louis Sullivan. He said Clinton's health care plan would result in a huge tax increase and a massive new government bureaucracy. Clinton favors a plan known as pay or play. It would force employers to provide health insurance to their workers or pay into a fund that would insure uncovered employees. The president wants a plan that would rely on a market-based solution and encourage workers to join together in health maintenance organizations. Clinton says the president's health care proposal would do nothing to control costs. Health care costs are increasing at a higher rate than inflation, but Clinton has yet to spell out exactly what he would do to bring them down. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
There are new reports that the U.S., Canada, and Mexico have now reached agreement on a plan to form the world's largest trading bloc. The Associated Press reports that President Bush will announce the free trade agreement tomorrow morning at the White House. Differences over tariffs and cars have been the final barriers to an agreement that would create the world's largest trading bloc, a tariff-free zone. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 6 points to close at 3,331.10. on volume of more than 174 million shares. Trading today was fairly active. This is NPR News. Testifying today on Capitol Hill, Ross Perot charged that some U.S. government officials covered up indications that U.S. prisoners were left behind following the Vietnam War. The Texas billionaire said there is no question in his mind that men were left behind, and he believes he can prove it. Perot has been a leader in efforts to learn the fate of U.S. servicemen missing in Indochina. Perot says that he thinks the U.S. government should grant immunity to federal workers who may have covered up the issue over the last 20 years. President Bush has endorsed $10 billion in loan guarantees for Israel. Mr. Bush agreed to these guarantees during meetings in Maine this week with Israeli Prime Minister Rabin. Alan Dowd of Maine Public Radio reports.
The loan guarantees had been hung up over U.S. objections to Israel's building of Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. Although Rabin's partial freeze on the settlements is less than what the U.S. had wanted, Mr. Bush said he salutes what Rabin has done.
It was not an easy position, and I'm sure there are divisions in Israel on this position. But he took a lot of courage, and he has begun to implement that policy, certainly to the satisfaction of the United States.
Money from the loans will be used to help settle Jewish immigrants to Israel. The U.S. guarantees must still be approved by Congress, and Mr. Bush is making a personal appeal today to congressional leaders. The Bush-Rabin meetings in Maine were designed to improve relations between the two countries, and each man emerged from the sessions with plenty of praise for the other. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Kennebunkport.
A fire earlier today in Boston's John Hancock Building forced the entire building to be evacuated. Officials say the flames from a fire on the seventh floor filled the upper stories with smoke before the blaze was brought under control by more than 100 firefighters. More than 30 people were injured in today's fire. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. An Errol Morris film is distinguished by its style and subject matter. His first film, Gates of Heaven, was about two pet cemeteries in Northern California. Vernon, Florida, was a portrait of a small town. It featured, among other things, a couple who collected sand. In both films, Morris relied on people talking uninterrupted. The result was both entertaining and off-putting. Morris's best-known film is The Thin Blue Line. It's the story of Randall Adams, a man wrongly accused of murder, and it's credited with helping to get Adams released from prison. The film combines interviews with stylized reenactments, accompanied by a haunting Philip Glass score. Morris's new film takes on an unlikely interview subject, physicist Stephen Hawking. The film is based on Hawking's best-selling book, A Brief History of Time. Hawking is afflicted with a degenerative muscle disease called ALS. He can't talk and has movement in just a few fingers. His speech is processed through a computer. The film opens with the tap-tap sound of Hawking using his computer. Then we hear his synthesized voice. Hawking serves as the narrator throughout the film.
Which came first? The chicken or the egg? Did the universe have a beginning? And if so, what happened before then? Where did the universe come from? And where is it going?
I asked Errol Morris to describe his first meeting with Stephen Hawking.
When you first are introduced to Stephen, it's really hard to know how to carry on a conversation. Stephen speaks very, very slowly. In fact, he has no voice at all, as we normally understand it. He speaks with a voice synthesizer. So you have to wait for him to write out sentences on a computer. He has very, very limited movement. In fact, he can move just three fingers on each hand. And with those three fingers, he operates a clicker, essentially an on and off switch, picks out words on a computer screen, assembles those words, and when he has composed a sentence or several sentences, those sentences can be spoken using this artificial voice, this voice synthesizer.
How long does it take for him to put several sentences together?
A long time, a matter of 2-3 minutes. And in fact, while you're sitting there, the pauses can seem almost interminable. When you first meet him, you sit opposite him, so you can't see his computer screen while he's writing. So you're looking at him, he's clicking away, and after a period of time passes, he finally speaks. After I got to know him better, it was possible to sit next to him and look at the computer screen while he was writing.
Well, I noticed that you began, first we hear his computerized voice, And then it begins with an extreme close-up into his eyes. And very slowly, we begin, you show us his body. And by the time that there's a full shot of him in his office, in his chair, with his computer, and you begin to associate this voice with a body, it's still shocking to see how immobilized he truly is. Did you get used to that as a filmmaker?
I don't think that you ever get completely used to it, but you become used to Stephen Hawking certainly as a person. And Stephen is a person who I like very, very much. It was a great privilege to be able to work with him, but it was also an enjoyable experience. He's funny. He is fun to be with. The answer is yes, it is something that you get used to. And it can be shocking to people at first. Stephen is as incapacitated as a person really can be.
The only real movement we see are just the almost imperceptible flutter of his fingers.
The movement of three fingers on each hand, the limited movement of his head from one side of the chair to the other. He can chew food with great difficulty. But aside from that, he has really no movement at all. And the strangest thing of all, going back to my first meeting with Stephen, the strangest thing of all is how can somebody who is so physically incapacitated be so much in control? One quickly feels dominated by Stephen Hawking. He's a person who, in the end, does not seem disadvantaged.
Let me ask you about the way you go about making a film. And it was certainly true in this particular film. You built a set, a rather elaborate set, for the interviews that you did with Stephen Hawking's family and his colleagues. Do you feel you lose anything by bringing people to this established set that you might get if you had them in their own home?
Well, for a long time, I've had a number of beliefs about nonfiction filmmaking. What makes a nonfiction film as opposed to a film with actors? And I've tried to play with those ideas in every film that I've made. Certainly, The Thin Blue Line tried to play on ideas about fantasy, self-deception in the real world. But what is essential to me is the way people talk, extemporaneous conversation, what people say when they're given the license to say virtually anything they choose. The element of reality in my films comes from those conversations. And apart from whether or not it's in someone's real living room or on a stage, those conversations are very much real. These are the real people in Stephen Hawking's life.
So as a filmmaker, you're really much more interested in what people say than how a particular film looks.
I'm very concerned how it looks, but less concerned about the idea that a nonfiction film has to be, for example, like cinema verite, that it has to have handheld camera available light, that a nonfiction film can be as elaborately constructed, stage lit as a dramatic feature.
I notice you're avoiding the word documentary. You're saying instead nonfiction film.
Although I'm happy to use the word documentary as well.
But it sounds like you're trying to say something by not using the word documentary and by using the word nonfiction film.
I think that documentary has so many associations built into it, that term. And I am fascinated with the idea of creating a different kind of nonfiction filmmaking. If you like documentary filmmaking, that breaks some of what we take to be the rules, the established rules of how a documentary or a nonfiction film is put together.
Errol Morris is my guest, and he's just completed his latest film called A Brief History of Time, and it was inspired by Stephen Hawking's book about some of the ideas that he had about the cosmos. Stephen Hawking is a well-known scientist who has ALS. It's a degenerative disease, muscle disease. And we're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Filmmaker Errol Morris is my guest. Let me ask you about your style of interviewing and how you get people to reveal something about themselves. I understand, my understanding is that you do sit out the silences. As you said, you were comfortable talking with Stephen Hawking because you're used to sitting through silences. Do you find as an interviewer that people want, there's a kind of a natural tendency to fill up those silences, and that's when people begin to reveal themselves?
Yes, I do. Years ago, before I even started work as a filmmaker, before I made my first film, Gates of Heaven, I interviewed people on audio tape, and my goal was to keep these interviews going for as long as possible without saying anything.
So does that mean you're using your eyes, your body in some way to encourage someone to keep going?
I'm not sure how it works, but I know that I've often thought the important thing if you want to have someone talking and if you want to keep them talking for as long as possible, the important thing is not to listen to what they say. The important thing is to look like you're listening to what they say.
So what are you listening to?
The strange thing is when you start listening to what people say, often you become distracted. You react to what they say. You give them visual clues that make them want to stop and ask you questions. Whereas if you devote yourself wholeheartedly just simply to looking at them and wishing them to continue, often they oblige you by going on.
Did you have to learn how to keep quiet? Because, of course, the tendency is to fill in those silences and to be encouraging with one's own words as an interviewer.
Well, I try to make up for my silences during my interviews with people by talking as much as possible at other times.
So that's it encourages them then to trust you, that you'll be with them.
I think I'm a receptive audience. I know that all of the people that I've ever interviewed, I've liked them on some level.
Is that important?
I think that it is important to have a connection with the people that you're interviewing, or somehow it's a dead enterprise.
You're working on a new film called Six Stories.
Yes.
Is that right? And part of
the title changes on a daily basis.
So it's Six Stories today?
Perhaps five stories tomorrow.
Okay. But you have introduced a new piece of machinery called an Interitron.
Yes.
And what it does is allows, or I guess forces, the person that you're interviewing to look directly into the camera.
Yes.
How does it work?
Well, the Interitron was named by my wife, Julia. I've often been bothered by the fact, when I interview somebody, or at least in the past when I have interviewed somebody, I put my head directly against the lens of the camera. Sometimes I put my arm around the camera so that my head is as close to the lens as possible. If you know where to look, you can actually see my hair drifting into the corner of the frame from time to time. And my cameramen have to grab the back of my head and pull me back. to keep me from going further in front of the lens. But I've often been bothered by the fact that when people are talking to me, they are still not looking directly into the lens. They are looking off to the left or off to the right. And so I developed this new device, the Interitron.
Sounds ominous, you know.
which, for better or worse, I've now trademarked. Which puts a half-silvered mirror, it's essentially a teleprompter, in front of the lens, with my image on it, my live image on it. The person being interviewed looks at my image and, in fact, is looking directly into the lens of the camera. And I am seated off to the side in a booth, looking at the exact same sort of contraption, that half-silvered mirror, this time with the subject's image on it that comes from the video tap of the camera, and a camera directly behind that half-silvered image, that half-silvered mirror that takes my image and puts it on their mirror in front of the other camera. It's the difference between what I call the faux first person and the true first person. That when someone is looking directly at you, that this is true first person cinema. And it's paid off.
Filmmaker Errol Morris. His new film, A Brief History of Time, is about physicist Stephen Hawking. It opens in New York and Los Angeles on August 21st. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about today's show. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Marty. Today we'll have the news of what President Bush and Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin had to say at Kennebunkport. The president now supports the extension of $10 billion in loan guarantees to Israel. We'll also hear a reaction to that development from Hanan Ashrawi, one of the Palestinian negotiators in the peace talks. Also, we'll be hearing a lot about Los Angeles on today's program. Ina Jaffe reports on the trend toward enclosed communities, people who live within walls. Some say it prevents crime. Others say it destroys community. Also, a talk with Mike Davis, author of City of Quartz, about Los Angeles.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. John Harbison is one of the major figures in contemporary classical music. He's won a Pulitzer, a MacArthur Genius Grant, and this summer he's composer in residence at Tanglewood. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new recording of Harbison chamber music performed by the Lydian String Quartet.
I like John Harbison's music in any form, but it's his chamber music that I seem to keep coming back to most. A new recording features all his chamber music for string ensemble, his two string quartets, and an extraordinary piece for piano and string trio called November 19, 1828. The first quartet is an intimate work, easy to follow, though emotionally complex. It ranges through movements marked, sometimes rather deceptively, amiable, bitter and intimate, and fugitive. Here's the haunting main theme of the amiable first movement. Its Eastern flavor suggests Harbison's long interest in Indian mysticism. The second quartet is more complex in design, with five movements based on the formal patterns of classical and pre-classical music. The third movement, called recitative and aria, embodies what I love most about Harbison's music. its quietly heartbreaking melodies and emotional openness. November 19, 1828 is one of Harbison's or anybody's most original inventions. The title refers to the date that Schubert died. The piece is a touching memorial to Schubert, seen darkly through 20th century eyes. The second movement is called Schubert Finds Himself in a Hall of Mirrors. It's a brief suite of enchanting Schubert imitations, played right side up and then upside down. In the third movement, Harbison actually uses an original Schubert theme, an early rondo. This, Harbison writes, is the only music in this piece that was composed by Schubert in his first life. A week before he died, Schubert went to a music theorist for advice. He was assigned to write a fugue on his own name. Harbison ends his piece by composing the fugue that Schubert never lived to write. The performances here are flawless. The Lydian String Quartet is one of America's finest chamber groups. From their inception in 1980, they've balanced classical music with a concern for what's being written today. Three of the original four women remain, violinist Judith Eisenberg, violist Mary Ruth Ray, and cellist Rhonda Ryder. Early music specialist and noted Ives expert Daniel Stepner is the new first violinist. The loving pianist here is the distinguished composer Yehudi Weiner. I think they must all love playing this wonderful music as much as I love listening to it.
Lloyd Schwartz reviewed a new album of John Harbison chamber music. I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The United Nations may soon approve a resolution which would call for the use of force to ensure the delivery of food and medicine in Bosnia. On the next Fresh Air, a look at the possible military options in Bosnia-Herzegovina with defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London, James Adams. I'm Marty Moscowane, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.